All right. So I knew I was going to be speaking today, and I almost left the house without my Bible, which would have been a bad thing, right? Thankfully, you have a phone now, and I have my Bible on the phone, too. But I'm really worried about going too quickly. And you might be saying, why would you be worried about that? Because quick is better, right? Quick is good. But I don't, Kathy told me that Jack said if he ever had to speak, it would probably be over in 4 minutes. And I thought, if I read fast enough, I might be over in 4 minutes myself. And that would leave a lot of time for Sunday school. So all those Sunday school teachers that are always complaining about, we never have enough time, today might be your day to have enough time. But anyway, is it me or is it hot in here? It's me because I'm up here in front of a bunch of people. How many people enjoy speaking in front of a group of people? Okay, weirdos out there. My wife being one of those. So one of the things I'm trying to ease into this because I'm a little nervous. But one of the things that people say, would you rather do this or that, this or this? And it's just, would you rather do this or speak in front of people? Give a speech, public speaking, any kind. And they always, except for the weirdos out there that raise their hand. They always say, I would rather clean out the horse stables than stand in front of a bunch of people or whatever. Come up with whatever terrible chore you can come up with, and they'll choose it versus speaking in front of people. So, see my knees moving? It's because they're knocking together. But anyway, enough of the introduction. That's not the introduction. We're going to talk today about grace and unfair grace. And if you... the parable that Terry read for us, you can kind of get the feel for the unfairness of that in that parable. And so I'm going to try to illustrate, and I hope it's not me, but God speaking through me, that you will understand what my point might be, in that we look at grace and just how unfair it is. But can you think of any words in use today that have totally lost their original meaning? Words that by their overuse, that's been overused incorrectly throughout the years, that the other meaning, that original meaning, is almost entirely lost. Well, I'm a child of the 80s, and one of those words that we used and abused back in those days was, anybody want to guess? Oh, my sister's not here, so she would probably know it, but awesome, right? Everything's awesome, right? It's even a song in the Lego Movie. Everything is awesome. So another one from that time period is radical, right? That took on a tubular, gnarly, all of those. So when we look in the dictionary to see what awesome really says, what it really is supposed to convey, the meaning, it is... extremely impressive or daunting, inspiring great admiration. Pike's Peak is awesome would be the correct way to use that. Great admiration, apprehension or fear. Awesome is something to do with some fear or apprehension. But we didn't use it that way back in the 80s, and it's still not used that way today. Today it mostly means it's extremely good or excellent. Right? So I had an awesome weekend. You didn't have a extremely impressive weekend unless you, came into a lot of money or something. But we use it as a modifier to say, that was a good weekend. Good and awesome, they're not equal words when you think about it, right? Awesome should, has more weight to it. Another word that's more, has fallen into this tendency more recently would be something when I was with the youth group, they always talked about it. It was epic. This is epic this and epic that. And I was like, do you even know what epic is? Again, I had an epic weekend. It's like, okay, well, let's look at what an epic weekend would look like if we were using the original definition. Let's see. It is a long poem, typically one derived from the ancient oral tradition, narrating the deeds and adventures of heroic or legendary figures or the history of a nation. Or It's a really long film, book, or other work portraying heroic deeds and adventures or covering an extended period of time. So an epic weekend would mean a three-day weekend because it's a long weekend. No. But instead, epic was filling in. They were using it to say, oh, that's particularly impressive. Not just impressive, but particularly impressive or remarkable. That book was epic. That would be the proper way to use it, because if I'm reading Beowulf, that's an epic poem, right? But if I said, Philip's got epic hair, not the way. So you can see how using words incorrectly over years and years, and maybe not even that long, but they start to take on a whole new meaning versus what the original meaning was. And you're probably wondering, it's like, what does this have to do with grace? Well, the word grace, right? It appears that the word grace hasn't fallen into this tendency of a word that by overuse and being used incorrectly over time has lost its original meaning. When we think of grace, even today, it still retains a lot of that blessed meaning from the original. So some of the things about grace, it comes starting from the late 12th century. It was meant God's unmerited favor, love, or help. From the old French, it's grace. This probably, if I did a French accent, I would add the French accent. It would probably sound a lot better. But the old French grace is pardon, divine grace, mercy, favor, thanks, elegance, virtue. That's around the 12th century. From the Latin, gratia, again, favor, esteem, regard, pleasing quality, goodwill, gratitude. Also in the in Spanish, you get gracias. Again, you can see the root of the word grace there. And also, starting around 200 years, some 200 years later, from the 12th century to 14th century, it starts to take on the sense of virtue that we know today, that of beauty, of form or movement, a pleasing quality. In the classical sense, from Greek mythology, we have the three graces. There were three goddesses, the three graces, beauty, charm, and forget the other one, but and then in music, there's something for the musicians out there, something called grace notes, right? There's something added there, and it's an embellishment that's not essential to the melody or the harmony. And then we all talk about, we're about to go have Thanksgiving, depending on how long the sermon goes, and Sunday school, but we will say grace before a meal. And some places they say grace before the meal and after the meal. I guess they say it after the meal in case the cook was not that great and they're happy to be alive. But I've never had that experience because my mom and my wife are both good cooks. So so we see grace even now when we think of grace. Everything I read that goes back to the 12th century, which is 1,000 years ago, to today, grace still retains that meaning that we see in the earlier parts of it. The Greek word for grace is charis, charis. And we get the, you know, some of the words charismatic and things of that nature. We show gratitude. Again, the root of the word grace is there. And then there's the opposite, ungratitude, which is the opposite of gratitude. We also see persona non grata, another piece where that happens, you know, someone who doesn't exist. So grace, as opposed to epic and awesome and radical, has retained its meaning throughout all these hundreds of years. So grace, we have favor, kindness, friendship, God's forgiving mercy, the gospel distinguished from the law, gifts freely bestowed by God, God's benevolence to the undeserving, God's character. It's actually a part of who he is, God's character. So we have unfair grace, and we're going to see why is grace even needed, right? So grace is needed. It's like, well, all we have to do is go back to Genesis 3, and we see, you know, Adam and Eve had their episode in the garden. And we can see even then, as grace is being part of God's character, in that moment of the fall, you know, God already has a plan in place. And the fancy theological word for that is the proto-evangelia, the first expression of the good news at that point. But if we look in, and we're going to be jumping around a little bit, but if we look in Romans 3, verses 10 through 12, we'll see why the grace is needed. And starting in verse 10 in Romans 3, as it is written, none is righteous, no, not one. No one understands, no one seeks for God. All have turned aside, together they have become worthless. No one does good, not even one. There's a lot of repetition there of no one, no one. So there's no one that does good. No one, not even one. No one understands, no one seeks God. This is why we need grace. This is where, and this an illustration came to me as I was thinking about, you know, just why we need grace. And we all know that in God's world, his economy will say that the standard is 100%, right? It's all holy. You have to be holy. You can't miss the mark. And so this came to me anybody who's going to school, been to school, or thinking about going to school, I was in high school. I was going to a small Christian school, and it was what's called an ACE school. It's an, anybody know what an ACE school is? Accelerated Christian Education. And so So my parents thought, hey, that'd be a good idea to send Todd and his siblings to a Christian school for once and see if we can't, you know, smack the bat out of them. But anyway, it was an accelerated Christian school, and one of the things that they have is that they don't have like a teacher classroom environment. It's more of a individualized, so you get your own little cubicle, and you get these things that are called PACEs, which are, I'm going to guess, but I never knew what it was, what the letter stood for, but it was personalized accelerated Christian education, perhaps. So a PACE, the idea being each student can work at their own pace. It all was like somebody really thought that through, right? The whole working at your own pace. So the idea is that in each of the subjects, you're working individually. You have to do a minimum of 3 or 4 pages a day to get through. But if you're feeling especially motivated, you can do as much as you want at your own pace, right? So you go through 1 year of PACEs would be like 12 of these, and they're little booklets, kind of workbooks type things. So you work through that, you get through one year. So one of these years, I was in high school, and I was really loved social studies, so I was just busting through social studies. And I think I did 25 of these social studies in 1 year. The thing about this is you'd go through the PACE, you finish it, and then you take a test on what you've just gone through. Now, I had come from public school where if you got a, 60%, it was a D, it's passing, right? And I come to Christian school, accelerated Christian education, and if you get an 80%, that's passing. If you get a 79, sorry, you got to do it all over again. So I'm like, wait a minute. This is not, anyway. So you got 80% to pass it. So this particular year, I was feeling really good about social studies, and I got through my first one, got 100. Second one, 100 on the test going through. 100, 100, 100, all the way through. And they, you know, when they have a morning chapel or something, they recognize, you know, the people who are getting hundreds. And so, you know, you start to get an ego build that, hey, I got 100, got 100. And the headmaster of the school at the time, right, you know, it was, I was on 23 out of 25 that I eventually finished. And he jinxed me because he said, hey, just want to bring a note that Todd has been perfect all year in social studies up to, you know, so I had 23. So my next test, guess what I got? No, not a 79, not that bad. I missed one question. missed one question out of 20. So it gave me a 97%, right? A 97%. And then I got the next one to the next test, 100 again. So all hundreds except one. I missed one question for that whole year, 25 tests, 20 questions in each test. That comes out to 500 questions for the whole year. And I missed one. I got 499 correct. And then my buddy next to me, he got 80s all year. And he did about, let's say, just to keep the math easy, he did 25 as well. How many questions does he miss over 25? Right? He misses 100. Here's the 100%. I'm really close. He's not quite so close. And then somebody else could be way down here and miss them all, and they're way down here. Who needs grace? All of us need grace, even if I only missed one. The only thing, and as I was thinking through this, you know, the analogy kind of falls apart a little bit in that that was only social studies. I should have been getting 100 in math, getting 100 in English, getting 100 in science, getting 100 in whatever elective. I should have been trying to be perfect or needed to be perfect if I was going to meet, as, you know, in God's case, his holy standard. It can't be just one part of my life that I am excelling in. I have to excel in all parts, all aspects of it. So there you go. Now you know. I missed one question. I don't remember. I tried to forget, right? Anyway, but yes, it still sticks in my craw that I missed one question. But no. But that goes to show, right? If we look at it, it doesn't matter how many more hundreds I could have gotten. If I just kept going and going, I missed one question. The highest I can ever get mathematically is 99.99999 something all the way out. It will never get to 100. I've missed that one question. I need grace. And it doesn't matter if I've missed the one question or if I've missed 100 questions, I still need the grace, right? So everyone misses the mark, but we need 100% righteousness in that. And the requirement is, if we look in Job 8:3, it says, does God pervert justice or does the Almighty pervert the right? He is looking for the right, his standard. And going back to, again, to the fall with Adam and Eve, we see that that's where that was missed. It was missed with our initial ancestors, Adam and Eve, and we're still missing it even today. So everybody misses the mark, whether it's missing it by one or missing it by 100. So we have grace. Now we need, well, we have a need of grace. So who's going to provide that grace? We have a grace that is provided. Let's look, if you will, in Romans 5. Verses 15 through 19. Something to keep in mind is grace costs the giver everything, and it costs the receiver nothing. The giver voluntarily gives something he owns, makes himself poorer to the benefit of the receiver. So Romans 5, 15 through 19 says, but the free gift is not like the trespass, for if many died through one man's trespass, much more have the grace of God and the free gift by the grace that one man, Jesus Christ, abounded for many. And the free gift is not like the result of one man's sin, for the judgment following one trespass brought condemnation, but the free gift following many trespasses brought justification. For if, because of one man's trespass, death reigned through that one man, much more will those who receive the abundance of grace and the free gift of righteousness reign in life through the one man, Jesus Christ. Therefore, as one trespass led to condemnation for all men, so one act of righteousness leads to the justification and life for all men. For as by one man's disobedience the many were made sinners, so by one man's obedience the many will be made righteous. So this is where the grace is provided. We know we needed grace. We missed the mark. God, again, going back to Genesis, he already had something in mind, and this is what he had in mind, is Jesus sacrificing himself on the cross. Didn't cost us anything, but what did it cost God? You know, when you see John 3:16, it says it's his only begotten son. It was one, his one thing, something unique, something valuable, and he gave it, right? So if we look at 2 Corinthians, it comes out of his wealth. 2 Corinthians 8:9 says, "For you know the grace of our Lord Jesus Christ, that though he was rich, yet for your sake he became poor, so that you, by his poverty, might become rich." Again, something was given out of his wealth to us. We were in abject poverty when it comes to talking spiritually. And he left, and in Philippians it talks about, I think it's in chapter 2, where it talks about, you know, he left heaven to become, to take on the form of a man, to put on the flesh. And he had, was, you know, kind of like living the high life, as if Jesus could live the high life. But, you know, he was there, palace, riches, the whole nine yards, everything. And he took on poverty so that we could become rich as well. Grace is not about being first or last. It's not about keeping score. If it's about keeping score, then my missing one question should garner me some sort of benefit. And some of you jokers who would lose, you know, miss 100 would not get as much benefit. Oh, hey, I'm already gone longer than I expected. But if it's about keeping score, my missing one should matter more than missing 100. But in this situation, my missing one is equal to missing 100 or more. So it's not about keeping score. It's not about being first or last. It's about, not about record keeping, no scales to balance, no list to check off. I mean, we've all been, you know, seen where some people want to saddle us with a list. It's like, if you have this, you know, check these boxes in order to be considered righteous. It's not about that. Nothing we can do can get us grace. No amount of works can make us righteous. Grace has to be freely given and received. I can't buy or earn it. I can never get enough test answers correct to get to 100%. So now we see, we come to where the passage that Terry read, and I kind of called it grace unfair or grace revolutionary, because it is revolutionary when we think about it. So let's take a closer look at our passage. If you remember, we have the landowner, and he's got a vineyard. He's looking for workers, and he goes out and he goes to hire, and he goes out at the first of the morning, which I think in this time frame is 6 a.m., and he hires some guys, and he goes recruiting. He gets some guys for the 6 a.m. hour, and he negotiates a pay rate with them. And in, I think it's a denarius is in what Terry read, Matthew 20, verse 1 through 16. Let's go ahead and we'll read it again just so it refresh it. So in Matthew 20, verses 1 through 16, "For the kingdom of heaven is like a master of a house who went out early in the morning to hire laborers for his vineyard. After agreeing with the laborers for a denarius a day, he sent them into his vineyard. And going out about the third hour, he saw others standing idle in the marketplace and said to them, 'You go into the vineyard too, and whatever is right I will give you.' So they went. Going out again about the sixth hour and the ninth hour, he did the same. And about the 11th hour, he went out and found others standing, and he said to them, 'Why do you stand here idle all day?' They said to him, 'Because no one has hired us.' He said to them, 'You go into the vineyards too.' And when the evening came, the owner of the vineyard said to the foreman, 'Call the laborers and pay them wages beginning with the last up to the first.'" So he's paying the guys he hired last, and he's paying them first, and he's paying the guys he hired first last. Let's see. And when those hired about the 11th hour came, each of them received a denarius. Now when those hired first came, they thought they would receive more, but each of them also received a denarius. And one receiving it, and on receiving it, they grumbled at the master of the house, saying, "These last worked only 1 hour, and you have made them equal to us, who have borne the burden of the day and the scorching heat." But he replied to one of them, "Friend, I am doing you no wrong. Did you not agree with me for a denarius? To take what belongs to you and go. I choose to give to this last worker as I give to you. Am I not allowed to do what I choose with what belongs to me? Or do you begrudge my generosity? So the last will be first, and the first last." So here we have the landowner. He goes recruiting. He goes out early, finds some guys. He goes out again about 3 hours later, finds some more guys. They agree. Ninth hour, all the way to where it gets to the end of the day, probably around 5 p.m., where 6 p.m. would be the quitting time, and he hires some more. And when it's all done, he pays the guys that he hired at 5 p.m. the same as that he paid the guys that he hired at 6 a.m. Anybody think that's fair? Raise your hand if that's fair. No? No, of course it's not fair. It's not fair, obviously, in our world. And this is where, again, where we're thinking, in our own, well, this is what's fair. And the landowner is thinking, who does it matter? Does if the workers think it's fair or if the landowner thinks it's fair? The landowner is looking at it saying, "I hired the guys at 5 o'clock for denarius. That's what they agreed to. I hired the guys at 6 a.m. for denarius. That's what they agreed to. I'm paying what I agreed to pay." It's the workers who have a problem with the fairness, right? And everything in the world, the world that we know, it depends on what you or I do as to whether we, whether it's a positive or negative. I get 100 on my test, and I'm getting the praise for that. Or if I had failed the test, I would be getting the negative aspect of that. If I go into the world, I'm working. If I do a good job, it's what I'm doing that I get that praise or whatever might come out of that. Forgiveness is unnatural. when you're only thinking about justice and what's fairness, forgiveness doesn't come into the equation, right? It's unnatural. That's why whenever we see an example of somebody forgiving, it's a big deal, right? Even the press and the secular world, they hone in on that and they say, "Well, look at that." The reason why they're saying "look at that" is because it's not normal. We don't need to go looking very far to see, that the world is all about justice and judgment. Normally, it seems the individuals looking for judgment or justice are looking for the judgment and justice as long as they are not the target of that judgment or justice, right? It's not fair, but I'm thinking of fairness for myself. I'm not thinking of fairness for my neighbor, my coworker, a family member, whoever it might be. One of the things that we all kind of learn early is the poet W.H. Auden, he writes, one of the things is that I and the public know what all school children learn. Those to whom evil is done do evil in return. We learn early on, if we're not believers, we learn early on that if, an eye for an eye is what the world is expecting. The fairness, the justice, the judgment. Something's been done to me, somebody needs to pay. And the poet Auden here, he wrote this in 1939. I think he was he was a New Yorker who was of Polish descent. 1939, Germany invades Poland to instigate or kick off World War II as we know it. So he's there, but we can even look at the time of the early church in the first century, they were trying to start, get the church going in that first century under Roman rule, and they were being persecuted, and they had every right, according to what the world says, to say, wrong's been done to us, somebody needs to pay, because later on, Christianity becomes the state religion of the Roman Empire. If it was a worldly body, worldly organization or something, they may have been looking to say, all right, I remember you. Yeah, you did that to me, so I'm going to get back at you. That's the world's way. We see it in history, even in our own country. Everybody's heard of the Hatfields and McCoys, right? That is two families. I think it was in Kentucky, Ohio, across the border there. Well-known grudge holding. But you could be, and I'm sure nobody even remembers what the one thing, or if there was just one thing, or it was a number of things that kicked off the initial feud. But you could be a child born 80 years later as a Hatfield or a McCoy, had nothing to do at all with whatever happened 80 years ago, and you're born into that, and you're expected to hold that same grudge. One person is offended or hurt. Another person wants to even the scales, and they want justice. We know this. In fact, we have probably been involved in some way at some time with something like this. A friend, a neighbor, or even a family member. Somebody has offended us, and we want justice. We want to justify. We want to escalate. We want to try to balance the scales. Am I holding a grudge? Am I seeking to make things right? And right according to whom? Usually it's according to the way I want things to play out, right? But Jesus' way is opposite. One thing also to remember is that an example of, if we look at recent history or somewhat recent history, is South Africa, the apartheid state, and Nelson Mandela. The apartheid state crumbles, Mandela is let out of jail, and the black population that had been persecuted for so long was suddenly in power. And there was a lot of clamor for the new government that was being run by majority black politicians and leaders. They wanted, there's clamors like, well, let's make things right. And making things right meant doing to others before they can do to you, which is a different take on the golden rule, obviously. But Mandela, to his credit, they created what they call a reconciliation commission, where they didn't look to go to balance those scales. They looked, as the title of the commission was, to reconcile. And that's what it would take, is it's going to take that forgiveness. Somebody has to forgive. In the case of the Hatfield and McCoys, however long that feud goes, somebody has to decide, it stops with me, and I'm not going to continue and run with it. In our own country's history, with Abraham Lincoln, at the end of the Civil War, he had in mind, there was many in his government, in his cabinet, that wanted to get retribution against the South. And he said, no, we need Reconstruction. That's more of a positive way to say, we need to build them up. They're Americans too. And, he went away from the revenge aspect to say, they've paid with blood just like we've paid with blood. And he was more along the lines of, let's build them up. Reconstruction was his way, similar to, with Mandela in South Africa, where there's like, let's end this, let's move forward, reconciliation. So Jesus' way is opposite of, let's get revenge, let's balance the scales. His way is 180 degrees the other way, going in a different direction. His way depends on him and what he has done. It is not on us. We merely follow. We no need to achieve, no need to keep score. We just need to freely achieve. In Jesus' way, we also don't seek to balance the scales. We leave justice up to God. So if, as believers, we have accepted that grace, but if we have that grace and we're still looking to balance those scales, looking for justice, it means we don't trust God to get justice for us. In fact, if we look at Romans, let's take a look at Romans 12, 18 and 19. Romans 12, 18 and 19, it says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves, but leave it to the wrath of God, for it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. We're not to seek out justice. God is going to take care of that. And if we are believers and we're seeking out justice, we don't trust God to do what he says he said he would do. If we move on to verse 20 of that same passage, we'll see he doesn't leave it right there. Don't just seek vengeance. He says, to the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, feed him. If he is thirsty, give him something to drink, for by doing so, you will see burning coals on his head. He doesn't leave it at just let me get the vengeance for you. But he takes it further and he says, just like Jesus would do, he takes it further and he says, you know, feed your enemies. In Matthew, I think it's also in Matthew that it talks about love your enemies as yourselves. Matthew 5, 43 through 48, we won't go there. But love your enemies as yourselves. And why would he tell us to do that? Because we're supposed to be like Christ, right? Who were we, if not enemies of God, before we became believers? And who did God give Jesus to? His enemies. He loved his enemies. We're to love our enemies. And that's what's so revolutionary about this. and unfair, right? It's like, just like, in the crucifixion of Christ, you have the two thieves. And one of the thieves there said, you know, came to Christ at the last minute. He's the guy that gets hired in the last hour, probably not in the last hour, the last half hour. And he's getting the benefit of salvation. Whereas you have all of these disciples who are have been with Christ from the beginning. The thief on the cross has the same benefit of that grace as the first disciple that was called to follow Jesus. We are to show grace and forgiveness in a graceless world. Grace is that character of God that is so opposite that the world knows that it can only stand out, that it can only come from God. Many of you may have heard of Corrie Ten Boom. Her book, there was a movie called The Hiding Place. She and her family, a Dutch family, they hid Jews during World War II. And she had every right from an earthly perspective to not forgive and to hate the Germans. But if you read her story, you'll see that she came to a point where that she could actually forgive her captors. I think she actually faced her captors at some point. Another example more recently is a church shooting in 2015 in Charleston, South Carolina. A shooter shoots up this Bible study and he gets captured, he knows, but the surviving members have forgiven him. Now, they've forgiven him, they've shown him grace, but he's still in prison, and he still may face the death penalty. That just goes to show that just because grace has been bestowed, again, God says vengeance is his, and he's going to take care of the justice, and in this case, God working through the government's authorities. If we read Romans 13, we see that God is working through government authorities to sometimes bring that justice. And in the case of this church shooting, that may be the case as well. But the thing to notice is that when something like this happens, it draws people to that and says, that is different. That weird, let me say it that way, that is weird. That is so outside the realm of everybody's experience in the world that it draws people's attention. It stands out because it goes against what the majority of people would be used to seeing. They go back to what the poet said about, you know, those to whom evil is done, evil, you know, let me read it again because I won't remember it. I in the public know that what all school children learn, those to whom evil is done do evil in return. And this goes, the other, you know, puts it on its head. So God has practiced the love, this love, your enemies, for what, you know, we were his enemies before we became Christians. And the world out there, they need that grace. They are currently enemies, and they can also accept that grace. They can accept that free grace even now, and they can become believers as well. One other thing I wanted to point out, and the parables, Jesus' parables are chock full of how his grace is played out, and one of them, well known, is the prodigal son. We won't read it. I think most everybody is mostly familiar with it. But in that culture, again, going back to the idea of enemies being enemies and loving your enemies, in that culture, when the younger son was saying that he wanted his inheritance now, he was essentially saying he wanted his father dead. If that isn't showing enmity or being an enemy, what is? It's like, I wish you were dead. Give me your money. So, and we have others in the story. We have the older son. We have the father. We have servants. We have friends of the son. And then, I don't know about you, but I tend to relate to the older son because I'm about fairness. And he, in this case, at the end, he's like, well, what about me? When do I get my fatted calf? When do I get what's mine kind of thing? He is all about fairness. But I just wanted to think, you know, the thing about the prodigal son is it's the third in three parables that are told in Luke 15, and it's all about, when you read those three together, you can see, you know, the shepherd in the first story about losing the 99 sheep, and the reaction of the shepherd when he finds the one, and then the lady who loses the coin, her reaction when she finds the coin, and in the prodigal son, the father when the son comes back and he finds the son. It's all rejoicing. But I've always wondered, it's like for the first story, you know, you're one of the sheep. Put yourself as a sheep. You're one of the herd. And, you know, Terry gets lost. The shepherd goes, I'm looking for Terry because he gets lost. And as one of the other sheep, you're like, oh, where's the shepherd? Oh, we got, you know, hey, we got free reign. But I'm thinking of when they finds Terry, comes back, and there's great rejoicing. If I'm one of the other sheep, I'm looking at that, and I'm thinking, if sheep could think, I'm thinking that it's like, wow, just one sheep, and he's rejoicing over finding that one sheep. I'm thinking, if I get lost, he's going to come after me just the same way. The same with the coin. And in this case, if you were one of the servants, because in the parable, you know, you get the main characters. But I kind of like to look for the characters that are there that aren't mentioned much, but you think, what would they have been thinking about just standing there? So you have the servant who comes to the father or is told by the father, it's like, hey, go get a fatted calf, this, that, and the other thing. We're going to celebrate because he's come back. The servant that goes talk to the son and says, you know, hey, there's a party going on. That's what you asked. There's a party going on because your brother's back. And he's seeing both sides of the grace equation, right? He's seeing, here's the justice. The brother saying, he doesn't deserve that. And on the other side, he sees the father saying, he came back. He's the son. We're going to celebrate. That's the grace. That's the unfairness. So one thing I like to do when I read parables is try to find one of those minor characters try to put myself as that character, one of the other sheep that's not lost, Terry, and see what would my, if I was that person and I was watching it all play out in front of me, what would I be thinking? And in the case of the prodigal son, I'm thinking, wow, that the father really cares, the father really loves, the father is forgiving. Because in the world that we have today, and even then, by all rights, the father could have, you know, whatever punishment he had decided, he could have tried to put on the son. But instead, he does something revolutionary, accepts him back, takes him back, just like he had never left. So, to close, and you're like, oh, finally. To close, I have something from a book. Philip Yancey's What's So Amazing About Grace. And if you're looking for a book on grace that will challenge you and what the church and the, you know, the church in America, kind of the popular version of grace and what grace I think really looks like. And that's what I'm kind of trying to get to say, what does grace really look like? It's What's So Amazing About Grace. It will challenge you because it will say, it will make you think about who deserves grace. But there's a story in here, and I'm going to warn you ahead of time, there's kind of a harsh word in here. But I'm going to use it just because sin is harsh. But from his book, it's about the civil rights period of in America. It's like, in the 1960s, a Yale Divinity School graduate and Southerner named Will Campbell befriended a student named Jonathan Daniels. Campbell and Daniels were each involved in the civil rights crusade. During this time, Campbell's theology was undergoing some testing. Much of the opposition to his civil rights work came from the quote-unquote good Christians. Campbell found allies more easily among agnostics, socialists, and a few devout Northerners. He was challenged, he said, he was challenged by one of these agnostics to say, what is the Christian message? And the person who was asking him this was P.D. East. He was a newspaper editor who viewed Christians as the enemy. And Campbell replied, we're all bastards, but God loves us anyway. The definition stung this newspaper guy, P.D. East, because he had grown up without a father. So he'd been called that word his whole life. But one of the things that was going to test Campbell was that, and test this idea that we're all, you know, God loves us anyway because of we're sinners, is that the night, on this night, when Campbell and his buddy Jonathan Daniels, they, it was an Alabama deputy sheriff named Thomas Coleman gunned down Campbell's 26-year-old friend Jonathan Daniels, the guy that he'd come down to with. It was that night that Campbell again speaks with the newspaper guy, East, and he got the most enlightening theological lesson he had ever had in his life, as he stated it. And he wanted to press Campbell to see whether his definition of faith, that God loves us anyway, no matter, you know, how bad we are. So he asked the question of the guy that got shot, Jonathan. Was Jonathan a bastard? He asked, and Campbell replied that though he was one of the most gentle guys he'd ever known, it's true that everyone is a sinner, and in those terms, yes, he was. All right, so is Thomas Coleman, the sheriff who shot Jonathan, is he a bastard? And Campbell found, that question Campbell found much easier to answer. He said, you bet he is. He's a murderer. Then this newspaper guy pulls himself closer and he said, looks directly into his eyes. He's like, which one of those two do you think God loves most? Which one of those two, the one that shot or the one that was shot? Which one of those two I won't use the word again, sinners, does God love most? So he says, suddenly everything became clear. Everything. It was a revelation. I began to whimper, but the crying was interspersed with laughter. I was laughing at myself, at 20 years of ministry, which had become, without my realizing it, a ministry of simple liberal sophistication. I agreed that the notion that a man could go to a store, fire a shotgun blast at one of the customers, and that God would set him free is almost more than I could stand. But unless that is precisely the case, then there is no gospel. There is no good news. Unless that is the truth, we only have bad news. We are back with law alone. So it struck him that he was thinking that grace is only for those that he thought deserved it. He was challenged in that, does this Alabama deputy who turns out to be a member of the KKK, does he deserve that grace too? I deserve that grace, but not my neighbor. Or I deserve that grace, but not the drug addict. Or I deserve it, and fill in the blank with whoever might be in your sphere of influence. Is our view of grace only that the grace is who we think deserves it? Or is it for everyone? As, you know, John 3:16 says, God so loved the world that he gave his only begotten son, so that whosoever, not who we decide, but whosoever, right? So that hit me. Is there anybody that I'm withholding grace from that I'm not supposed to? Do I not engage certain people because I don't think they deserve it? But why do I deserve it? So this impacted him. He turned himself away from the whatever ministry he was doing at the time, to where he became what he called a missionary to the redneck. He started to, and by redneck he meant the KKK, the racists in the South. And again, this is the South during the time of the civil rights in the 60s. And so if anybody needed to hear about the grace of God and have a missionary, it would be these folks as much as anybody else, right? So he turned himself into a missionary to the Klansmen of the time. And so we have the unfairness starkly shown to us, is that even, again, going back to the test, he may have thought, it's like, these guys that are striving, that are only missing one or two questions on all these tests, they deserve that grace. But these guys that are missing 100, 200 questions, or maybe not even trying, they deserve that grace just as much. Grace extends to the KKK just like it extends to the civil rights marchers. The math of grace doesn't make sense to us. It just is because of God, who God is. It is part of his character, part of who he is. Is the church showing God's grace, or do the folks that need grace the most, are they avoiding church because they already feel bad enough? And they think they're going to feel worse if they come. So, sentence sermon. From C.S. Lewis. I know pastors quoted him a few times lately, but C.S. Lewis, he kind of, as he can do, he was such a good writer, he can put so much into one sentence. And he says it here. To be a Christian means to forgive the inexcusable, because God has forgiven the inexcusable in you.